Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Horticulture Week podcast. I'm Rachel Forsyth, senior reporter at Hort Week, and this week I'm joined by Bald Hills Managing Director Jay Goodard. Hi, Jay.
Thank you for having us.
And head of horticulture, Harry Baldwin. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Rachel.
Thank you both so much for coming on the podcast. I'm really excited to delve into everything. But first, I thought, in case of any of our listeners haven't heard of Bald Hill, it's a country garden set within 383 acres of heritage listed parkland in West Sussex. It's got beautiful views, beautiful plants, and we're going to hear all about it from Jay and Harry. And so, Jay, you know the gardens, I think it's fair to say, pretty well. How long have your family been looking after Bald Hill?
So I'm the fifth generation of the Stevenson Clark family to be taking over the reins at Bald Hill. So my great-great-grandfather, the Colonel Stevenson Clark, first established the garden and our nationally important horticultural collection from 1893. So it's actually our 130th anniversary this year. So, we've been here for quite a while, and hopefully we'll be here for another 130 years to go as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you grow up in the gardens, get to explore all its hidden crevices as a kid?
Yes, exactly. So yeah, my brother and I moved in with my parents when I was six and my brother was four. And we've just actually, myself and my husband, have just taken over the reins and moved down with my boys, who happen also to be six and four. So it's a lovely kind of transition of that family heritage.
Yeah, how beautiful. I mean, what an amazing place. There's no better place to grow up, really, is there?
No, indeed.
And Harry, in comparison, you're fairly new, but you're certainly not new to horticulture. And you've had some pretty well-known gardens on your resume, including Kew. But what's your favourite part of your job at Bald Hill?
Oh, crikey, that's a big question.
yeah, sorry, I mean, I'm diving in with a big one.
I mean, there's just so many exciting elements. You know, like I said, you know, coming from a Kew background where my interest is trees, but also history, Bald Hill really sort of was really my thing.
Perfect.
It was a perfect job to move to. And I think, you know, there's so many elements to Bald Hill, but of course all these exciting plants and trees that aren't just necessarily in the garden, but all across the wider estate. But it's really the archive that really keeps everyone on their toes, and there's always new, exciting, new information coming out of this wonderful portal, you know, which is telling us every week more and more about our special garden.
Does it influence anything that you're doing in the future, kind of looking back at those archives, discovering new things?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I'd probably say that, I must probably just say that, you know, this is a really exciting archive. We've got about 75,000 artefacts, which details things like just drawings, photos, even letters from the very plant hunters in the Victorian era, yeah, writing to the Colonel from the depths of China, attaching seed packets. So you've got this really nice, interesting link between the archive and the living plant collection. So you've got this wonderful narrative when you walk around the garden. Mm. So every now and again, we're finding, you know, new old garden diaries which are detailing plant names, some of which these plants no longer are sadly with us, but there are plants still hidden away in those crevices waiting to be found, which of course then informs us about propagation and then sharing that material with other important gardens around the country.
Yeah, of course. Oh, how exciting. And we're going to delve into kind of some of the heritage collections that you can find in the garden a little bit later. But I thought I would start off with quite an exciting visit you had recently. Adam Frost came, right, to come and film BBC Gardeners World. So what is it that they took a specific interest in?
So I think Adam really wanted to find out, you know, what's really unique about Bald Hill, what separates that from so many other gardens. And what I really wanted to get across was for me, what makes it exciting is the fact it has been within the family for the last 130 years. So we've got this long-standing sort of stability and direction, which is going forward, which just means that things are keeping to our ethos, if you like. So that's really exciting. But then underneath all of that, we've got all our champion trees. We've got in excess of 70 champion trees, the largest of their kind in the British Isles. We've also got, you know, a large number of historic trees and shrubs as well, collected from those plant hunters from many, many years ago, many of which are actually threatened now in the wild. But there's also another side of the whole thing, is the fact that Broad Hill is well known, or certainly was well known, for breeding so many different plants, probably between the 1920s and the 1950s. And some of these are still very, very, well, I guess they're still famous today. They're still in the nurseries and internationally known even today, which is kind of exciting. So, yeah, there's just so many elements to Broad Hill, which just really makes it exciting. And I really wanted to try and get that across to Garden as well. And fingers crossed I did. So do stay tuned into our social media when it comes online.
Yeah, we will. And Jay, what were you hoping people will kind of get from watching, or will get from watching that episode about Broad Hill? What will they take away?
I think what makes Broad Hill so special, and I hope that the viewers of the programme really enjoy, is just the kind of breadth and depth of our beautiful horticultural collection. The way that the garden is laid out as a series of garden rooms, there are just all these little pockets to discover with really different and unique plantings and plant species from all four corners of the world. And it's just wonderful, you know, this kind of journey of discovery that visitors can take through the garden and see plants from the Himalayas, you know, China, Andes, Japan, the Americas, etc. So I hope that viewers are able to really enjoy the beauty of the plantings that we have here by watching the programme.
And you also were visited by BBC Radio 4's Gardeners Question Time. So it's been a busy time of year for you guys. What were some of the most interesting questions that arose from that?
It was really interesting to see it actually in person, I must say. It was really good fun. In fact, you kind of wanted to throw your hand up actually and comment with almost every other question. But there were so many questions really that came up, you know, things that are really current. So, you know, there's always the common question is, what should I be using instead of my box? What else can I use? You know, for quite a few years now, we've been, you know, Wisley, of course, have done that fantastic trial, and it started to make headway. And then, of course, we had the really hot summer last year, followed by a really wet winter, which has kind of turned everything upside down. So it feels like we're almost starting again in trying to find what is actually the best replacement. So that was a really interesting discussion. And I thought another really interesting point that someone mentioned was, you know, why aren't my flowering trees and shrubs, you know, the summer flowering trees and shrubs flowering so well this year? And that was a really interesting thing to be brought up, because of course we had that long hot summer. It meant that so much of the wood was ripened, which has enabled them to flower so well. But of course, flowering, you know, lots of a very proliferous tree sometimes means that it could have its last hurrah. So it's, well, I guess we'll see if things are going to pull through next year.
Yeah, absolutely. What's Broad Hill doing in regards to box?
So we've been trialing something like a euonymus. It's called Jean Hughes, and it's quite a small fastidiate shrub, small evergreen leaves, and it is actually doing pretty well. Well, it certainly has done really well up until the winter, when we had a really long late summer, which sort of lasted well into late November. So the wood was still ripening, and then suddenly we had a hard frost, which really took it back to the ground. So in hindsight, you know, we should have perhaps covered it, but you know, no one really knows how hardy or how robust this thing is. So it is proving to be a good replacement, but I think it's important to start. We should have perhaps covered it up, I think, with some fleece just to give it a bit of extra protection.
Well, now you know, it's trial and error for sure, isn't it?
It is.
So, Jay, although you're not new to Broad Hill, are you fairly new to this role as managing director?
Yes, so I've spent the last 20 years working in PR and marketing. I was at Nike for 10 years and Apple for 8. So I've officially taken over the role as managing director of Broad Hill for the last 12 months. But it's, you know, really exciting kind of going full circle and coming back to my roots and coming back to my home down at Broad Hill.
Yeah, it must be a dream job, really. And you recently announced some really ambitious and really exciting plans for the future of the gardens. And we will delve into those details in a second. But I wonder if maybe you could start us off by kind of summarising what your ultimate vision is for Broad Hill. You know, say if we were to jump ahead 10 years and land back in Broad Hill, what would be the biggest difference that we'd see?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think what's interesting about my vision for Broad Hill and the future is that being a family estate, every generation has really left a legacy and left their mark. So my parents, for example, really brought Broad Hill forward, made it much more of a commercial business, which is very much needed. They focused on all year round colour. And also really celebrating the best in British gardening by working with some of the most notable garden designers, both more established such as Chris Beardshaw, but also young and up and coming. So Sophie Walker was the youngest female at the time to win RHS Chelsea. So throughout by working with them, they've really collaborated to bring new life into the garden rooms. And then looking forward under my tenure, we're really thinking about the 21st century and the challenges that actually all gardens face, but how we can connect communities more closely with nature. There's so much written now and so much research that shows the mental and physical benefits of being outdoors in nature. And we've got a hugely ambitious project, which is called Reinventing Broad Hill. And it's very kindly supported by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. And that is all about connecting our local community with the beautiful setting of the South Park, which is 110 acres of listed heritage parkland, but with a key focus on wellbeing and education. Because we really think that those are the ways that we can engage more people with the beautiful setting that we have at Broad Hill.
Yeah, I'm really interested to hear more about that South Park, but actually, because you're opening that up, right, and trying to connect it to the local train station via a cycle and pedestrian route. So how will that work? Will they pay entry once they get, you know, to a certain point on that trail, or is it going to be completely opened up?
Yeah, exactly. So we will, and the benefit of the location of Broad Hill is that we're just on the edge of Hayward's Heath, and Hayward's Heath is the biggest commuter train station in the southeast. So there's a huge opportunity to reach a lot of people. So we will have, we will open up South Lodge, which is on the southeastern corner of the estate, and that will enable people to walk or cycle from Hayward's Heath station to Broad Hill for the first time and walk straight onto the estate through a little pay point entrance at South Lodge. So it will make Broad Hill one of the few Sussex gardens that will be accessible via green transport in terms of foot or bicycle. So we're really excited about unlocking the South Park for the 38,000 people in Hayward's Heath, but actually people across the southeast and further afield.
Yeah, it is really exciting. Is there anything that you need to do to the landscape to prepare for this change?
So we've been working very diligently in terms with our design team in terms of the plan to make sure that all of the enhancements that we make have as little impact as possible on the heritage listed landscape. So we're looking to improve existing paths as much as possible. We're, for example, building what we're calling our Eco Lodge, which will be our community hub. It'll be a beautiful building and it will actually sit on the water of the lake. That will enable us to minimise the impact on the wider heritage listed parkland which surrounds it. So we are thinking, we are being very mindful about the listed nature of the setting.
Yeah. Harry, are there any tree species in particular going to keep an extra eye on?
Oh, crikey, there's loads in the South Park. It's almost like...
You need about 1,000 eyes.
I know, that's the thing, yeah. So no, there's some really exciting trees down there. You know, so many trees that are, you know, just are just so unknown. You know, there's just many, there's very little other replicas, if you like, throughout the country. So, you know, and a number of them are champion trees as well. So right now we're doing a really big inventory, not just across the South Park, but across the garden and the estate as a whole, trying to understand, you know, what do we have? You know, what is in poor health? what do we need to propagate? So that should give us then a list of priorities about what we should be propagating, and then putting it back into the landscape, you know, for those to enjoy and for education, really.
What are some of those examples, some standout species?
Oh, crikey. I would probably say, well, in the garden, for example, we have a really exciting tree called Illyriodendron chinense. And most people always think of, oh, the American tulip tree. But there is a sort of a counterpart. There's a species also found in Asia that was only really kind of discovered by the West in about 100 years ago. So Ernest Wilson in 1901 was sent by Beech Nurseries to collect a number of these seeds. And he came back and he sent them over to the nursery where they grew a number of saplings and would have shared them and sold them across Europe. And we were lucky enough at the time to get hold of a young sapling. And then a couple of things about 15, 20 years later, it then flowered. And it was known that Bald Hill had the very first flowering specimen outside of its native range. And Ernest Wilson actually wrote to the Colonel personally congratulating him and how excited he was to hear about it. So there's just so many interesting trees across the estate that have stories. And that's, for me, that's what really excites me and what I really want to get across to the visitor, is there's always so much more than just a flower or ornamental value. There's a whole backstory about how these plants came into cultivation and have been used medicinally, they've been used ethnobotanically, you know, for so many, many, many years.
Yeah, I actually had the pleasure of having a tour of the gardens with you, and I know you mentioned then you have to be so careful not to just take things out, because like you say, everything seems to have a story, and something that might not look like it's important could have a really big connection to the history of the family.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, even when we find more information from the archive, you know, oh, there's supposed to be a very small little shrub in the corner of the estate. You know, so I'm always very apprehensive about anyone taking anything out, really, even if it looks scrawny and horrible. You know, I think I would rather leave it and, you know, and just find out. So, I think I always tell the gardeners to be cautious.
Yeah, that's definitely a good approach.
Yeah.
So, Jay, you mentioned the Eco Lodge, and I know that it's also going to offer opportunities for wild swimming and yoga, which sounds so idyllic. I think you'll catch me there one day. And I know it's ticking that well-being box that you really want to look at. But I'm interested to find out what kind of preparations need to be made in that area before the public can enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Eco Lodge will very much be the hub in the heart of the South Park for visitors to enjoy the wider landscape around it. It will actually be built with Site One timber from the estate. So really thinking about sustainability and kind of best practice. It will have three key spaces. It will have a community space in the middle, a well-being space to the right for yoga, mindfulness and prayer. As you say, we will have wild swimming in the lake itself, and then it will also have a cafe which will serve biodynamic food and fruit and vegetables grown on the estate. So from the Eco Lodge, we will then have walking trails around the South Park, enabling our visitors to enjoy and learn about our champion trees and a lot of the history throughout the landscape. And then we will have a dedicated space for outdoor learning within Dinosaur Wood.
Yes, that's really exciting. And I know that's another huge thing you want to push, kind of getting kids interacting with nature.
Yes, exactly. I'm really excited. I'm a mum of two young boys, and you know, I see firsthand just really how they thrive being outside in nature, and just the wonder of childhood, and you know, there's a real eagerness to learn. So we're really excited about unlocking Dinosaur Wood and creating this forest of learning where children of all ages will be taken on a journey through the evolution of time, from the time of the dinosaurs to the present day. And through outdoor learning and play, we can teach them so much about nature, the natural world, but also working closely with local schools, groups and charities. It's been fascinating to hear from teachers, for example, you know, science, math, geography. There's so many areas of the national curriculum that we can actually facilitate in an outdoor setting rather than be in a more traditional classroom setting. So we're really excited about, yeah, Dinosaur Wood being this real hub of learning and exploration.
Yeah, and I, as well as being great for kind of their mental well-being and their education, I think it's just great for our industry as well. I think a lot of people who've come into this industry came into it because they had that very early interaction with nature and loved it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the more we can educate and kind of hopefully build an appreciation for nature, I think the more people will respect it and care for their natural setting. So yeah, absolutely, if we can foster future generations that are passionate about our natural world, that's only ever going to be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Harry, how much can we expect from the landscape? How much of it will be landscaped, so to speak, and how much of it is just what's there naturally and you're kind of managing the footfall around that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have the EcoLodge, you know, coming online, which will be an infrastructure. But I think the nice thing about the South Park is, in one sense, it kind of won't be changing. The spirit is very much going to be there. But the only thing we will change is perhaps how we manage the site. So, you know, we are still a few years away, so perhaps ideas would change. But it gives us the opportunity to think about things like restoring, you know, perhaps a wheeled-in meadow in the South Park, which again can be another great outdoor classroom, or thinking about how we can really manage our woodlands, you know, again for education and well-being space. But the South Park just naturally lends itself to being, because it has so much soft infrastructure, you know, like Jay said, we have these wonderful native woodlands. And yes, we do have, you know, a couple of, you know, non-native species. But again, that's a great way to talk about, you know, how the world is changing. So, you know, the site as a whole just lends itself perfectly for this sort of reinventing Broad Hill stage. And what better as well, the fact there's actual dinosaur bones, or was, inside Dinosaur Wood. So
really? Is that where it gets its name from?
Yeah, that's right. So in the early 1800s, when they were, it was previously known as Stone Pit, because it's essentially a small old quarry. And in the early 1800s, they found it's one of the earliest dinosaur bones of the Iguanodon, the family have still got today. And Mr. Clark brought out the bones to me, massive, great big thigh bone, put it on the table, you know. So it's got, you know, it's not just called Dinosaur Wood for a reason, you know, it actually had dinosaur bones there. So, you know, it's a great space to start thinking about, you know, flowering plants, you know, the evolution of that.
Yeah.
So it's just a really exciting outdoor space.
Yes, so much potential. But of course, it's not just about looking ahead. I know the history of the gardens is also incredibly important, as we kind of touched upon at the top of the podcast. So what are some of the standout historical specimens in the garden? I know that's going to be a really, really hard question.
Oh, crikey. It's always a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah, very difficult.
I mean, probably the most obvious one for me is, I think I must have shown you, Rachel, on our tour, is the Emmenopteris henryi.
Yes.
And this was first brought back by Ernest Wilson. But we've got a George Forrest collection in the garden, which was planted in the early 1920s. But it was made known by Ernest Wilson that it's the most beautiful, most foliferous and fragrant tree of the Chinese forests. So when that word got around to the West, everyone was very excited to get hold of some seeds and some plants. So when Broad Hill managed to get a small plant into the azalea ring, the Colonel was really excited to, of course, see this tree thrive and flower. But sadly, he died before managing to see it flower. And then the second generation, also knowing about how beautiful this tree is in the Chinese forest, it also sadly didn't flower in his lifetime, and nor did the third generation. But it was actually Mr. and Mrs. Clark's, Jay's mother and father's time that it actually flowered, almost 100 years later in 2011, which is a real curiosity. You know, no one really knows why it, you know, has taken so long to flower in a British climate. So when it flowered in 2011, we had all the press We had all the press here, we had the scaffolding, everyone climbing up, and there was actually only one small little flower at the very top of the tree. But it was still a real monumental moment to have that first flower. And then every 2 to 3 years, we would then get more and more flowers. And there was a fantastic flush of flower in 2021. So it is an interesting tree, and as again, it's another one of those trees that is now sadly threatened in its native habitat. So, you know, trees like the Emmenopteris or other trees that are sort of are important, found in gardens across the country, are, you know, sort of genetic banks of special information that, you know, many of these trees can't be saved in seed banks like the Wakehurst Millennium Seed Bank. So, you know, growing them in living collections like Broad Hill and other major gardens are incredibly important for saving that information.
Yeah, absolutely. Jay, do you have any favourites in the garden?
Well, I was just going to add to Harry's comments around the Emmenopteris, Henry, just to say that we launched a rebrand at the beginning of this season, and it was quite a big challenge to choose one plant or specimen from the extensive collection that we have across the garden and the wider estate. And we spent a long time thinking about what specimen might really embody our heritage, but really kind of what can we celebrate for the future. And we did choose the Henry I for our new logo as a demonstration of celebrating that heritage, but really thinking about how we stay fresh and relevant for the future. So yeah, definitely the Henry I would be up there as one of our particularly special. But I mean, at Broad Hill, we really do have important collections across so many different, so rhododendrons, camellias, azaleas, magnolias. I think probably the magnolias would want to be one of my favourite. There are some amazing specimens, and there are over 100 across the estate. There are three champions in the Garden of Allah, two from Japan and one from China, and they are particularly impressive when they're in flower.
Yeah, I was going to say that story about the tree waiting for it to bloom for generations, it kind of speaks to what it means to be a gardener and also to be a custodian of a place like Broad Hill. I suppose you're not necessarily doing these things for you to benefit yourself, but, you know, for future generations. So quite a nice thing to pick to kind of represent you.
Yes, exactly. And I think the way that we approach the garden and planning for the future is very much thinking in decades and centuries rather than just in months and years, because obviously, you know, that's reflective of nature as well. And some of the trees standing across the estate have been here for many hundreds of years. So it's important that we continue to protect them for the future centuries as well.
Yeah, definitely. And one of those threats is, of course, the effects of climate change. So are there any species you're particularly concerned about considering that?
Yeah, I mean, last year was a really interesting one because it, you know, it has given us some insight into perhaps what we should be thinking about.
Yeah.
But I think at Broad Hill, what really suffered, and it was really sad to see, was our heritage rhododendron collection.
Wow.
Certainly those that haven't really got a canopy layer covering them, because, you know, there are woodland species that need to have, you know, moisture. They need to have a good canopy in order for them to thrive. And some areas, you know, we don't sadly have that. So what we're trying to do is think about long term. What can we do to look after these for the future? But what can we do immediately now? So right now, you know, we're thinking about propagation. We're also considering micropropagation for those that are hard to propagate vegetatively. But I'm also trying to consider, like, long term, what can we do in these areas in order to conserve the mother plant? So in the garden, we're lucky enough to have some really nice, large, very nice canopy oaks. And I've been collecting a number of acorns off good specimens that will hopefully have good traits in their second generation. So I've been sowing a number of these acorns and long, deep root trainers. And I'm planning on sort of growing them on for a few years in order to plant them in, you know, in these areas to produce a good canopy layer above these rhododendrons. So that's sort of my plan. Mm. You know, people might think, oh, that's going to take a long time because oaks take a long time to grow. But actually, you know, when they're young and juvenile, it doesn't take long for them to get to 10, 15, 20 feet high. Mm. It's only when they reach, you know, that sort of age when they start to slow down. So I think, you know, using a native tree is going to be ideal for helping to save our collection as well, really.
Yeah, absolutely. You do have to kind of think on your feet, move with the times, move with the conditions as a gardener. And I believe you recently changed the way the rose garden is maintained. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So at Bald Hill, we're sort of very proud to be organic. You know, we don't want to use any agrochemicals or anything like that. So obviously that does come with a price. You know, we have to constantly monitor the roses, you know, for things like black spot and things like that. But there are many cultural practices we can do. You know, in the winter when we start to thin them out and we give them a prune, you know, that's great for airflow, minimizing pests and diseases. But what we've been trying to do, you know, of course, there's other practices like mulching as well, retain the moisture, keeping the weeds down. But, you know, the rose garden is generally, you know, any rose garden is a monoculture because you're just growing roses. But what's important is to then involving other plants, thinking about companion planting, you know, encouraging good beneficial insects like ladybirds, lacewings. So we've got a number of perennial borders surrounding the rose garden in order to keep on top of some of those nasty bugs that we don't want on our roses. So yeah, we're trying to just be as healthy as we possibly can in our rose garden and just across the estate as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Jay, have you noticed a difference in that rose garden yet? Obviously the new borders are a big change.
Yeah, indeed. And the box replacement is actually beautiful. It's I actually like the slightly less formal feel that the new box replacement has added. But I mean, the rose garden is such a beautiful setting. It's got 750 different rose plants within it, and that tranquility that is brought by the partner planting around the formality of the roses, it creates a really beautiful setting. But I was just going to add to what Harry mentioned around the importance of organic principles, because that is very much a thread and a pillar that we continue across the wider estate, both in terms of regenerative farming, but also through biodynamics. So we've established a new growers project at Selworth Farm, which is one of our farms, and that's the site of our market garden. So we're growing biodynamic fruit and vegetables for our future restaurants, but also for local restaurants and farm shops, etc. So yeah, a biodynamic approach, really working with the land, with plants and with nature, is very much true to all of us at Bald Hill.
Are there any kind of other changes to the maintenance of the garden that you two both would love to see going forward? It sounds like you're doing a lot of innovative stuff, but is there anything kind of on the list that you'd love to try out?
Do you mean in terms of thinking about climate change and things like that, Rachel?
Yeah, climate change, if there's any other like new practices that you've heard of that you'd love to try out that are kind of very sustainable, kind of in that realm of work.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're experimenting really all the time, you know, and things are always surprising us. You know, we sort of think, oh, you know, that shouldn't be working in that sort of climate, or, you know, these strong summers that we're getting now. But, you know, things are surprising us. But one thing, you know, like we touched on earlier, we think in decades. So really thinking, you know, what is going to be growing well in 10 years time, but also thinking about pests and diseases. You know, we've got, you know, well over 1,000 different pests and pathogens that are sadly now in the UK, which are causing havoc amongst our plants and our gardens and our native wildlife. So really being careful about what we choose to plant is so incredibly important now. One thing we planted recently for the Queen's Green Canopy Project is Ulmus New Horizon. Now, of course, sadly, you know, we lost so many of our mature elms across the British Isles, you know, many, many years ago, back in the 1950s. And now there's starting to be new strains and new types of elms coming in, which are resistant to Dutch elm disease. So we planted one called New Horizon recently, which still allows the white letter streaked butterfly, which is rare to the UK. So it still enables, it's still a good, despite being a hybrid, it still actually has a place in our native habitat. So I think it's just thinking carefully about what we are planting for the future, really.
Yeah, Jay, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to add that I think another way that Bald Hill is really special and unique is that we have our garden council. So for nearly 100 years, we've had a board of individuals who are arguably the best across the garden horticultural world. We've got members from Kew, Wakehurst, Royal Botanic, Cambridge, Edinburgh, and gardens across the country. And we meet quarterly at Bald Hill. But that just brings such a wealth of knowledge in terms of sharing ideas and best practice. I think something that's really wonderful about the horticultural world is that that shared enthusiasm and, you know, really putting the plants first and wanting to share ideas and best practices across those different gardens, you know, so that, you know, the plants ultimately survive as well as they can. So sharing different specimens, sharing seeds that we discover, etc. So, yeah, we're really lucky that we've got that wealth of knowledge to help guide us in terms of best practice and adapting to future challenges.
Yeah, it is definitely an amazing thing about the industry. It's kind of like, if you succeed, we all succeed. Everyone, yeah, no one's closed off, are they? They all want to kind of share what they know. You almost can't stop them, and share that passion and knowledge. It's great. Well, it has been so interesting to touch on some of the things you guys are doing. We also did an article with you, so if anybody wants to know a bit more, then they can find that on Hort Week. Or, you know, do reach out with more questions if you have them. My last question is one we always ask our guests, and that is, what plant would you take to a desert island? I don't know who wants to kick us off.
I'll take it off. I'm probably a little bit nerdy with this question, but I know.
That's great.
I think for me, you know, of course, there's going to be so many things I'd like to take to a desert island. But I think if I was to think back to my roots about what really got me into botanical horticulture, was probably when I was working at the Sir Howard Hillier Gardens. I have a fantastic collection of oak trees, but when I was working under this tree that I was unfamiliar with, you know, it had beautiful dark brown furrowed bark, and it had really thick bullate evergreen leaves. And I remember looking at the label and it said Quercus rhizophylla, and I remember reading up about it, and I didn't realise that there was more than 500 different species of oaks across the Northern Hemisphere. This particular one came from Mexico, which I had no idea, and it's such a beautiful plant that you know, people should be planting more of, because Mexican oaks are again another great tree to be planting for the future. So I'd probably say Quercus rhizophylla would be one of my desert island plants.
Amazing choice, Jay.
So I'm going to choose the Alfred Colom rose. I absolutely love roses. I think they are such beautiful plants that really give throughout the season, and, you know, relatively easy to maintain. We've obviously got such a beautiful collection of roses in the rose garden here, but the Alfred Colom especially is meaningful to me. We actually planted one. My firstborn son is called Alfred, so it's a special rose to me in terms of our family. But yeah, I just it's such a beautiful colour, and it's definitely something that would bring me happiness on my desert island.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the rose garden is named after you, so I think that's very fitting that you picked that. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I am so excited to see how this all progresses, and especially since you guys are kind of on my doorstep, so you'll probably see me trudging through the South Park at some point in the future.
Thank you so much for having us, Rachel. We're really excited about this next chapter at Bald Hill, and if any of the listeners would like to find out more, please do visit our website. We're really excited about reinventing Bald Hill, but it is a hugely ambitious project, and we do have a significant amount of partner funding to raise. So any support that the listeners can give, we'd be hugely grateful as we enter this next chapter.
I'm Rachel Forsyth, and this has been the Horticulture Week podcast. Make sure you never miss one. Subscribe or follow Horticulture Week podcast via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. If you are interested in producing a podcast with Horticulture Week, email us at hortweek@haymarket.com. Huge thank you again to Jay and Harry, and goodbye for now.